Let's begin. My apologies, last week I uploaded but late, so I don't know why. It's there now. So we should be able to. Okay, and this is today's source page. This is the page I had intended to give you last week, so we're going to work off that, and we're okay. We started our study of principle number five, or fundamental, or foundation number five, all different ways of translating the concept of Ikare Emunah. So just a quick review of that first paragraph, because it's important for for the second part of our discussion. Hayesod ha-chamishi shehu yit'aleh hu asher ra'ui le'avdo ule'romemo ule'fasem gdulato mishma'ato. The fifth foundation is that it is proper to serve him, blessed be he, to ascribe to him greatness, to make known his greatness and an obedience to him, make known to fulfill the idea of fulfilling his commandments. Ve'en osin kein l'masha l'mata mimenu. And we may not do this to anything that is a lesser being or anything that is underneath him. Whether min ha-malachim ve'kochavim ve'galgalim ve'yisodot, whether they be of angels or stars or celestial spheres or elements or anything formed from them. All these things have predetermined natures that have no authority or control over their actions. Such authority and control is only in God's hands. Similarly, it is not proper to serve them as intermediaries in order that they should bring us closer to God, but rather to God himself we must direct our thoughts and abandon anything else. Essentially, what we started to look at last week was the fact that in this principle, the Rambam identifies a number of different issues. And then he concludes and says, "Verov ha-Torah ba'al lahazhir azeh." Actually, there's a line missing in the English translation. "Zeh yesod ha-chamishi hu ha-azara l'avodah zarah." This fifth foundation is the prohibition of idolatry. "Verov ha-Torah ba'al lahazhir azeh." And the majority of Torah comes to warn us, engage, tell us about, or inform us about this prohibition. So there is a number of different themes that the Rambam introduces here, and he seems to mix them all together. And part of what we started to explore last week is the relationship between each one of these ideas. In fact, in some way, he identifies three different ideas here. The first is let's put them in any order you want.
Proper to serve God.
Serve God.
I don't know.
Right? Serve God by telling of his greatness, fulfilling his commandments, describing to him greatness. All of that is under the foundation of Ra'ui Le'avdo. Second. Right, not to serve any lesser beings, no lesser beings. I call that avodah yeshira, direct, not through any intermediary. And thirdly, the third is a little more subtle.
Even if you think they're helping you to serve Hashem.
Right, so the Rambam talks about that in Hilchot Avodat Kochavim. Even if you're serving these lesser beings for the intent of indirectly serving God, that no lesser beings, even, I'll put that as a subcategory, even if they are as intermediaries. I'm not sure how to spell intermediary, but that's all right. And the last piece that he introduces.
Direct everything to God himself.
Have to direct everything to God himself. The third is a little bit more subtle because I think it's directly connected to this, but because he throws in a new terminology, I think there's actually a distinction to be made, and that's the very last line where he says that this is all connected to the concept of Avodah Zarah. I'm not 100% convinced that Avodah Zarah is identical to this idea of not serving God through any intermediary. I think one is a subset of the other. So I would see them as, I put them as three different ideas, but they're all connected. So we have to serve God. We have to serve God directly, not through any intermediary, and certainly not to serve something else completely, or some other concept called Avodah Zarah. We have yet to determine what this concept of Avodah Zarah is. So I put that out there, because by the end of our discussion, what I'm going to suggest to you is that Avodah Zarah is actually is a much broader concept of which this notion of not doing the intermediaries is a part. But then it actually goes beyond just the terminology that we would talk about when we talk about idolatry. So those are the three ideas. And what I showed you last week, we started to explore the Rambam in Hilchot Avodat Kochavim, where he talks about the history of idolatry and goes back to the story of the days of Enosh when man started to look at various physical things that could represent God to him because God was too abstract, too different, too distant, too difficult a concept to grasp. And so they started to look at representations or servants of God, to use the metaphor of the king. And they could be the creation itself, the stars, the sun and the moon, the spheres, that which serves God by representing the entourage, if you will, or even taking it one step further, looking at the various forces of nature, forces of society, anthropomorphic values in the Greek terminology of religion and theology. Every personality trait of the human experience is deified into a God, and therefore you kind of represent God in human terms. There are various ways to try to grasp the concept of God in less abstract ways. Because conceptually, the notion of God is very hard to understand. Invisible, not physical, detached, removed, and yet imminent, engaged, service. It's a very difficult concept to get our head around. Much easier to grasp something physical and identify with it, and even talk about it as representing God or acting on God's behalf. But what's interesting to the Rambam is that the Rambam defines Avodah Zarah not as the second stage, as we said last week, not which the first stage is to represent God in some kind of, or to serve some sort of intermediary as a messenger or as a representation of God in a way of giving honor to God himself. Second stage is to forget that there's a God behind that concept. The Rambam defines stage one as idolatry, not only stage two. He says quite clearly, "Al derech she'avad enosh va'anshei dorot tchila, harei ze oved kochavim." If you serve God in the manner of Enosh, not second generation, third generation, where they forget God, but even in that first generation when they made the mistake of serving God through some sort of intermediary, even that is defined as Avodah Zarah. So I leave that as an open question as to why, and we talked a little bit at the end of the shiur last week about the determination of whose authority it is that determines what proper service is. We're going to come back to that concept at the end. Before I do, however, I want to spend a few moments and talk about a little bit of the historical context of idolatry. To us, idolatry is a very strange idea. It's so foreign, it's so removed from our frame of reference. Maybe if we became more familiar with certain cultures today that still have some kind of physicality to their worship of God, there are certainly some cultures in the world and in the Far East that still have that physical manifestation of religion. But even within Western society, within Western culture, for us, when we talk about classic idolatry, we have this image of Isaiah's famous description of the carpentry shop in which the idolatry is made. You know, one Isaiah describes in a cynical fashion where the carpenter takes a stick of wood, block of wood, and he chops it in half. And with one half, he throws into the fireplace and he cooks his dinner. And with the other half of that block of wood, he carves out an image, sticks it on his mantle, bows down to it, and says, "You are my God, you have created me." And you hear the irony and the sarcasm in that declaration. For most of us, we perceive idolatry in that kind of almost absurd format. And so it's so far removed from our sense of what any kind of meaningful religious experience would be. It's hard for us to get our head around what this idolatry was all about, why it was so powerful a force, spiritually and sociologically, in our history. What was it about idolatry that enthralled us and engulfed us for so many centuries? And to draw that question even, to make that question even stronger, I want to draw your attention to the source on the second page, source number 4, which is a quote from the Gemara in Sanhedrin, a passage about Rav Ashi. I think I may have mentioned this at some point. Rav Ashi is giving a talk or a lecture to his to the students in the Beit Midrash one day, and he says, Rav Ashi uki ashlasha malachim, he came to that Mishnah that talks about three kings that do not have a share in the world to come, one of them being the king by the name of Menashe, who, historically speaking, was probably the most idolatrous of all the kings of Israel. He said, tomorrow the shir ended, and he hadn't yet gotten to a discussion about Menashe, so he said, tomorrow we will open our discussion, our discourse, with a discussion about our friend Menashe. And friend, of course, in quotation marks. That night Menashe, or a colleague, that night Menashe came and appeared to him in a dream. And he said to him, Chavrech v'chavid avuch karitla, you have called me your colleague and the colleague of your father? He says, what am I, your equal? I'll challenge you in a halacha question. Now the halacha question specifically is not my issue right now. We asked him a question, what part of the bread do we recite, what's part of the bread is the piece for reciting the Hamotzi to be taken from? He answered, I don't know. Then he jibed and he said, you have not learned this because and you dare call me your colleague? He says, I know more halacha than you do. I'm a bigger Talmud Chacham than you. The specific question about Hamotzi is more symbolic than anything else. I'm going to leave that because it's not relevant to our discussion. So Rav Ashi said, so teach it to me. And tomorrow I will teach that halacha in your name. So he told them, take it from the crest. So then he said to them, tell me, if you are so wise, why did you worship idols? To which Menashe responded and said, I havit hatam, havit nakitna bishipule glima virahit virahat abatrai. Had you been there, you would have picked up the skirt of your garment and you would have run after me. You would have run even faster towards the idolatry. Rav Ashi was very taken by this discussion, and the next day, instead of beginning his lecture by saying, today we're going to talk about our colleague Menashe, he began by saying, today we will talk about our teacher Menashe. Just really an astounding statement for Rav Ashi to have made. So my question is a very simple one. What this passage in the Talmud is really saying is that we truly don't understand the lure of idolatry, the power that idolatry held over our people. What Menashe was trying to tell Rav Ashi is that it's not out of ignorance and it's not out of foolishness that Menashe was both wise and intelligent, and he was nobody's fool. And he certainly was scholarly, and yet he was drawn into the world of idolatry. part of it is certainly the political context. Part of it is the notion of the fact that every other society around them was idolatrous. Every other society around them had a certain cultural value system, and they wanted to fit in. They wanted to be part of the society. They wanted to share those values. And, of course, I think we can understand what that means. When you stand apart from the rest of civilization, that's hard. You want to fit in. You want to fit in amongst your friends. You want to fit in amongst your peers. You want to fit in amongst your neighbors. And when you are a power in the political play of nations in the ancient world, and every other nation, every other culture and society and kingdom plays by certain rules, you don't want to be perceived as the outsider. So that, I think, certainly plays a role. What Ravashi was saying to him, what Nasha was saying to him was, you live in a different time. You live in a world where that's not a social force nor a social law. So how can you judge what we lived through and what we were going through? That's one part of the picture. I don't think that that's the full picture. I think that there's something to the concept of idolatry, which if we understand what it is and we understand what its power is, I think we could probably identify where that power still exists. And that would probably help us understand both the danger that Avodah Zarah plays, as well as the modern equivalent from which we have to be increasingly aware and concerned. There's one more interesting source with regards to the danger of Avodah Zarah that it's not really part of this discussion, but I think it's important to put on the table. You should be aware of it. I included it here as source number 5. The Mishnah of Avodah Zarah records the following dialogue. Shalua does kenim beromi. The elders in Rome were asked the following question. The elders in Rome, referring to the Jewish sages, I think, maybe not. Says im ein mitzono be'avodah zarah, lama eino mivatla. If God's really not interested in idolatry, why doesn't God get rid of it? If idolatry is really so antithetical to everything that God wants from civilization, why doesn't God just get rid of the idolatry? He can. He could. Why doesn't he just poof, wave it away? So they answered, Amru lehen, ilu ledavar she'ein tzorech le'olam bo, hayu ovdin, hayam evatlo, if they would worship things that are really irrelevant, and we could do without, and you would eliminate them so that to avoid the temptation, I'd understand, perhaps. But they worship the sun and the moon and the stars. So what are you going to do? Eliminate the sun and the moon and the stars so that people won't worship idols? The world can't survive that way. So they answered, Yavad olamo mipnei ashotim. We're going to destroy the world because of the idiots. Amulam imkein, yavad davar she'en tzorech le'olam bo, v'yaniach davar she'tzorech le'olam bo. So then I'll give you another suggestion. Those who worship the sun and the moon, you're right, you can't get rid of the sun and the moon, we need them, they're important. But there are others who worship sticks and stones. Why don't you get rid of the sticks and stones that they worship and leave the sun and the moon? And the answer to that question is, of course, that if God were to eliminate the idolatries that are irrelevant and unimportant, but maintain those that are significant, what would be the result?
Reinforcement.
You would reinforce the theology of those who worship the sun and the moon. That's exactly right. So they said, we would be strengthening and enforcing those who serve those items. They would say that for sure gods. Because they were the ones who were not eliminated. Based on this passage, there's a famous Tosfot Yontif who said, a commentary on this Mishnah, who identifies this as one of the classic sources for the notion of free will. Because essentially what this Mishnah is arguing is that even that which God knows is antithetical to his mission, even things that God knows, detracts mankind from the focus of the purpose for which we were put into this world. God maintains, because the alternative would be for God to intervene in the world in such a way that it would eliminate our freedom of choice and our ability to choose to serve God in some meaningful fashion. But again, what this mission identifies is the fact that this notion of Avodah Zarah, of idolatry, is not just a nuisance, but it's somehow connected to the very fabric of the world in which we live. It's so critical, it's so necessary, it's so foundational to the world in which we operate, that to eliminate it, you'd have to essentially eliminate the world itself. You'd have to eliminate the sun and the moon and the stars. And so God will tolerate it even in even though it's antithetical to everything God is trying to get us to achieve. Yeah?
If it's so foundational, why are you saying that in modern times, at least in the United States, we don't feel it? If it's so foundational, we should have this desire to find things to pray at home.
Right.
You know? So I'm not sure that it's consistent with what you just said.
Right. So yeah, I'll give you two answers to that question. I think it's a very good question. If it's so foundational, and historically it was, why is it so much less of a draw and a power today? I can give you two answers to that question. One answer now, and one answer will have to wait until the next principle. The answer that will wait until the next principle is that Chazal asked that exact same question. And Chazal suggest that there was a period of time in which there was a conscious decision to find a way to break the lure of idolatry, despite how critical it was. And that story has to do with the return from the Babylonian exiles and the story of Purim, and there's a lot behind it. But we have to get to principle number 6, which is prophecy, to understand the relationship between prophecy and idolatry, and then I'll be able to answer that question in historical terms. On a simpler level, I think the physical manifestation no longer exists, but the draw of it in its lesser form, but no less dangerous form today, still does exist. So once we identify what it is, I think it will be easier for us to see that the power is still there, it's still potent, it's still a draw, and it's still a danger. And then we have to be aware of it.
You say that this introduced the concept of free will, just like the HRR, they don't eliminate that either. So that if you eliminated that, there wouldn't be any...
Well, that's essentially the same idea. But you can't eliminate the Yetzer Hara because you leave man without free will. Correct. So what is this power? What is this draw? What is this story of idolatry? And how do we understand it today? So what I would like to do is take you on a journey into the world of the Kuzari. I'm going to digress for a moment from the world of the Rambam, move into the world of the Kuzari. We'll come back to the world of the Rambam a little bit later.
Ask a question.
You may.
I'm just curious, when you translate Avodah Zarah, it's just slain service.
Right.
So does that include, you know, like none of an Aviyu died because they brought strange fire?
Right.
So Eish would Zara. That be considered Avodah Zarah also because it wasn't what God wanted? We use the term in terms of idolatry, but right. is it the concept of...
That's essentially where I want to go. So let's do the Kuzari first, and then we'll come back to it. But that's essentially, which we sort of alluded to at the end of the shiur last week, that I think is the critical question. We translate Avodah Zarah as idolatry. The actual, more accurate translation of idolatry back to Hebrew is Avodat Kochavim U'Mazalot, which is the service of stars and constellations, if I translate it literally. Or Avodat Elilim, which is the service of an Elil, which is an idol. Those are the correct, those are the accurate or literal translations of idolatry back into the Hebrew. The term Avodah Zarah is a term you won't find in the Torah. You'll find it in rabbinic literature. What that term means is what we're going to explore. But I think you are correct. It's more than just Avodat Elilim. Which is the service of idols, or kochavim umazalot, which is stars and constellations. Going back to the early generations of idolatry. Hence the term, by the way, if you're familiar with the term Akum. Familiar with the term Akum? The term Akum is used often in the Talmud to refer to Gentiles.
Right.
It's an acronym for Ovdei Kochavim Umazalot, those who serve stars and constellations. And it's essentially a generic description of those who are outside of the monotheistic culture who serve idols. Chazal, it became often used for general term for Gentiles, but that's its historical development. Right.
Non-Jew, but that's really not the best.
Because his generic, because the term gets developed or becomes identified with the generic term for non-Jew as it's used in the halach. So let's go now to this passage, this quote from the Kuzari. The Kuzari is dealing with essentially the development of idolatry. Where does idolatry come from? Where is the power of idolatry come from? Remember, I told you the basic background to the story of the Kuzari, with this dialogue between the king of the Kuzar people and the rabbi, as to what Judaism is all about. It's a philosophical treatise. And there he asks him the question about idolatry: how is it that your ancestors worshipped idols? The story of the golden calf. And he says, essentially, and this passage is not here, but he says with regards to the worshipping of the golden calf, says that wasn't really idolatry in the classic sense of the term. Idolatry in the classic sense of the term is to take something of physical creation and to say, you are my God. Well, they weren't really looking for you are my God. They were looking for, says the Kuzari, they were looking for some kind of physical item or object that would serve as a kind of intermediary, as the Rambam describes, between them and God. And he goes one step further. He says that, in fact, the Torah was anticipated that they would have some kind of physical object. And they knew that. Moshe had told them that he would go up the mountain and he would bring back two tablets of stone, and that those tablets would contain the Aseret HaDibrot, and that those tablets would be placed into an ark, and upon that ark would be two golden statues called the Kruvim. They knew something about what was going to happen. They just didn't have the details. And when Moshe didn't come back, they were looking for what it was that they needed, and so they embarked on a quest to find exactly what it was that would serve that role of the Ark and the Kruvim and the Luchot and the tablets, etc. And so they chose the form that they had seen in their vision of God when the skies opened up and they saw the Ten Commandments, and they saw a vision of the entourage and the throne of God. They had different things that they saw in the sky, and they chose one of them, namely the eagle or the shor, the ox, and they made an image of it. And they said, "Ele Elohecha Yisrael Asher Helucha Me'aretz Mitzrayim." These are the gods who took you out of Egypt. They acknowledged that God took us out of Egypt. They simply were misguided as to what the correct manifestation of that intermediary would be. So says the Kuzari. And then he concludes with a following statement, that this is not unlike the story of the ksil in the Beit Merkachat, the fool in the doctor's office. What is he referring to? And he's referring in that passage to the passage which I'm going to show you right now, which is a story that the Kuzari sets forth as a metaphor or a parable upon which he builds much of this foundation. Right. much of his religious foundation of what Torah is and how Torah operates is built on this passage of the story of the Ksil in the Beit Merkachat. So if we look at the top of what's identified here as page 1, paragraph one, section 1, paragraph 78, top of page 90. Zeh shorash ha'emunah v'shorash ha'meri. First, he sets forth the idea that shorash ha'emunah hu shorash ha'meri, that the root of faith is the root of heresy. The root of faith is the root of heresy. That's the phrase that the Khuzari uses from which he builds this whole thesis. Amar Khuzari, ech yeh shorash ha'emunah hu shorash ha'meri. How can this be? How can the root of faith also be the root of heresy? What does that mean? Amar chaver ken, ki advarim asher yukonu lekabel harishamim hahem, ha'elokiyim. Those things which create a favorable environment for divine influences, enam yicholat adam, they are not within the comprehension of man. V'lo yichlu l'she'er kamutam ve'ichutam, and man cannot explain them or understand them quantitatively or qualitatively. If they know what, they wouldn't know when. If they knew when, they wouldn't know where. There's always a variable missing. It's like quantum mechanics. There's always a variable missing in our understanding of what it is that creates the right environment for serving God. Proper understanding of these ingredients of how to serve God, how they are used, and what is needed for them to work properly require detailed clarification from God. In other words, what he's saying is, to serve God can be achieved in many different ways. But objectively, there's a right way and a wrong way. And that is the process of how to serve God, rightly or wrongly, is not a process that we can understand on our own, that we can come to on our own terms. We have to have that information provided to us by God. Whoever has acquired, I'll read in English for the sake of clarification, for sake of simplicity, whoever has acquired this knowledge and has followed the instructions down to the finest detail with a full heart, such an individual is called a believer and will be favored by divine influence. One who attempts to create an environment for divine influence by using research, logic, extrapolation, or by using what is written in the astrology books regarding the harnessing of spiritual influences or the making of talismans, if you try on your own, through your own initiative, through your own ideas, through your own values, through your own efforts, to determine what the right approach is to serve God, such a person is a heretic. Impelled by his own intellect, this person offers sacrifices and incense, but he really has no idea what he's doing. What, how much, where, when, with whom, and so on. What's the formula? How many sacrifices in the day is correct? How many is too many? How many is not enough? If we pray three times a day, is that too many times? Are we nudging God? If we pray twice a day, is it not enough? Are we not doing our service correctly? How do we know? This person is comparable to a fool who comes across the medicine cabinet of a doctor who is famous for his ability to heal the sick. The doctor is not in, and many people have gathered in his office to receive medicine. Right, so here's the image. There's a doctor's office. Pharmacists and doctors in those days were the same person. The line outside the door, down the block, people who are sick waiting for the doctor to examine them and determine what their course of medicine will be. The doctor is out to lunch. So the fool proceeds to dispense medication to the patients without knowing what medicines are intended for what sickness, and without knowing the proper dosages. Here's the medicine cabinet. Here are the sick people. Take medicine, give it to the sick person. Sounds good. What did the doctor do? The doctor looked at the person, determined which one of these medicines would be right for that person's illness, picked the medicine out of the cabinet, gave it to the person. So in walks the fool. He sees the people there. He figures, okay, he'll help the doctor while he's out for lunch. And he examines the first patient, and he says, okay, you need this medicine. And he examines the second patient, and he says, you need this medicine. As a result, he kills the patients with the very same medicines that could have been used to heal them. Because the same medicine, used properly, can heal. Used improperly, can kill. If by chance one person is healed by a particular medicine, then everybody else in line will clamor for that same medication, thinking that that will cure all their illnesses. And this will continue until by chance they find another medicine that heals them. What they do not realize is that the real remedy is in the prescription of the wise doctor, who mixes the compounds and knows exactly what and how much to dispense to each patient. The doctor would also prescribe for the patient the right diet, the right exercise, sleeping habits, environment, marital conduct, and the like. And this is how people were before the advent of Moshe. With the exception of a few individuals, people were seduced by a belief in the power of the stars, natural forces they wanted from religion to religion, from god to god, some even adhering to several gods. Eventually, they forgot the one who conducts and manages these forces and who placed them in the universe to benefit mankind. Instead, these forces became a source of harm to man because of man's inadequate preparation and his improper use of them. In other words, what he's saying is, the same medicine, call it service in some way. Let's talk about the particulars of the Torah. The Torah talks about sacrifices. Well, the pagans brought sacrifices to their gods. Idolaters brought sacrifices to their gods, and we bring sacrifices to our God. So the sacrifice is exactly the same. So what makes the one korban kosher and the other korban avodah zarah? What makes one type of service constructive, elevating, spiritual, and the other type of service idolatrous, dangerous, even self-destructing and deadly?
Well, in the first case, you're doing what you're told to do, instructed.
Essentially, what he argues is exactly that. What he argues is the fact that when we serve God, there is an objective right and wrong. It's a medicine. It has to do with the nature of the soul. And this the Rambam develops in another text called the Shmona Prakim. The mitzvot of the Torah are essentially medicine for the soul. That's a terminology the Rambam uses, where he talks about the soul being sick, having ailments, and the mitzvot being there to elevate us and to cure us of those ailments. Well, who can possibly understand what the ailments are if we don't have a frame of reference to understand what the soul is all about? How can we attempt to cure the ailments of the soul if we don't have an understanding of how the soul operates? It's outside of a frame of reference. The only one who can possibly explain to us how the soul operates and what is the proper conduct for the soul and what is improper for the soul is the one who made the soul, who understands the soul, who created the soul, who put us in that predicament in the first place. And therefore the Kuzari says there is an objective right and wrong to how to serve God, and that objective right and wrong can only be determined by
the Torah,
by God. Two, three principles later, we will talk about how that message from God gets translated into the Torah. Right. But essentially, first is the position that in order to properly serve God, we have to be told by God what it is that we are to do. What we cannot do, what we dare not do, is determine on our own what that proper service is. Because that is to determine on our own the nature of the relationship between man and God. Yeah.
there's something I don't understand.
Yep.
So you say that God's frame of reference is not something we understand.
Correct.
We're not capable of understanding that.
Correct.
Okay. Yet we're going to be we're going to be considering the Torah the message of God.
Well, we have to first establish the notion of prophecy and the prophecy of Moshe before we can get to the Torah. We haven't talked about the Torah yet.
But
we're
so
talking in the philosophical terms.
Isn't that like an intermediary?
No. What do you mean by isn't that like an intermediary? Is
well,
the Torah an intermediary? We haven't gotten to the Torah yet. The Rambam has said nothing about the Torah. We'll get to Torah in principle number 8. We're not there yet. All we've established right now is that there's an objective right and wrong as far as how to serve God. What the Rambam calls direct service, the Kuzari calls divinely revealed service, but essentially comes to the same thing. In order to know what the right path is, that information has to come from somewhere. The moment I define a right and a wrong mechanism, method, by which to serve God, I now have to determine the criteria by which I will know what's right and what's wrong. What the Rambam is suggesting, what the Kuzari is suggesting, and I think is implicit in the Rambam as well, is that the definition, the mechanism by which that information is given to us, has to be determined by God. It can't be determined by us. Any determination we make, whether we think it's in the right path or not, any determination we make on our own is by definition avodah zarah. Understand?
Well, I understand. I guess my question is more, how does the message from God come to us?
That's the next question. How does that mechanism come to us? How do we know that information? Where does it... Right? So if I tell you that it has to be revealed by God, I now have to provide a mechanism by which that revelation can take place. Right? That will lead us directly into principle number 6, which is prophecy. And then to principle number 7, which is the prophecy of Moshe, and then to principle number 8, which is the Torah itself as the message of the prophecy of Moshe. In other words, once I've established the need for a revelation, then the Rambam is going to introduce, okay, the answer to that question is, which is how. That's exactly the logical connection between principles 6 and 7, or between 5 and 6. Yeah.
From our frame of reference, we know what God wanted, unless we have the time. I know I'm jumping the gun, but just like we have our service and we say this is revealed to us by God, the people who worship idols can say, oh, our shaman told us this is what this God wants. Then you can get into Islam, you can get into Christianity. Everybody thinks they're right. I know we're right.
Right.
But that's my point of view.
So there's a difference. The difference between... yes and no. Historically, Avodah Zarah never made the claim of being a revealed religion.
Okay.
What essentially we're talking about in philosophical terms is the difference between a revealed religion and I'm not sure what the alternative is called, but a derived religion or a logical religion. Avodah Zarah never really made, classic pagan idolatry never really made the claim of being a revealed religion. In today's Western world, there are several religions that make that claim. Judaism makes the claim of being a revealed religion. So does Christianity, and so does Islam. So we will address the question of, is there a difference between our concept of a revealed religion and theirs? Both Kuzari and the Rambam have to address that question. Is there an objective difference between Mamre HaSinai concept and their concept of a revealed religion? I think there is, but we haven't gotten to that yet. And nor do I think it's really relevant so much, because I don't think the issue here is, are we more correct than anything else? The question here is, what's the framework upon which Judaism is based? there is a little bit of a polemic about other religious beliefs, but it's not the primary motivation here. Primary motivation is to understand Judaism. It's not necessarily to defend Judaism against other religious beliefs.
But isn't it much more difficult to understand Judaism than it is to understand these others? Because the pathway is
it's more complex.
Through the concrete material whatever, and here it's the absolute absence of that.
Right. So it's harder. The end goal is harder. The end goal is harder because you're trying to serve an abstract, in relationship with an abstract, with a transcendent rather than a tangible. Correct. Now, if that, I want to come back to the definition of Avodah Zarah and come back to a concept which you mentioned before, and that is the notion that this whole idea of the Kuzari, which is that Avodah Zarah is essentially, at the core of it, is essentially service of God not revealed by God or not determined by God, is implicit in the terminology of Avodah Zarah. And I think you correctly pointed to the phrase of the story of Nadav and Avihu. Nadav and Avihu are killed in the story of the dedication of the tabernacle because they bring an Esh Zara. And they take a frying pan and they place it in the Torah. Ve'aviu Esh Zara. The phrase in the Torah is Ve'aviu Esh Zara Asher Lo Siva Ota. And the Mephoshim are split up how to translate that phrase. Is it they brought a fire which they had not been commanded to bring? In which case, the term Esh Zara is a phrase that stands by itself. It happens to be objectively an Esh Zara, and it also happens to be something which they shouldn't have done because God commanded them not to bring an Esh Zara. Or is the phrase Asher Lo Tziva Otam the modifying definition of what makes it a Zara? What makes this Esh Zara is the fact that Asher Lo Tziva Otam. In form and feature, it could have been exactly the same as any other Esh in the context. Esh here referring to sacrifice, not referring to fire, but a sacrifice, or some kind of offering. In other words, was there an objective right and wrong offering? They brought the wrong offering, they mixed the incense in the wrong way, and that's why they were punished? Or could they have done exactly the same ketoret, in exactly the same form, in exactly the same manner, except that in this particular case they weren't commanded to do so, and therefore it became Zerah. Rav Hirsch builds his interpretation of the story of Nadav and Avihu along those lines. What made the Esh Zara was the fact that God had not commanded it. It could have been exactly the same as anybody else's. But the objective criteria of right and wrong here are determined by what God commands and what God doesn't command.
I just want to distinguish a couple of things. This is all about, if I'm reading the text correctly, it's an attempt to create divine influence. In other words, this issue of...
That's a Kuzari terminology. The Rambam doesn't talk about that terminology, but essentially they're both talking about the end goal of what the religious experience is all about.
Okay, but it very much has to do with the way you worship or relate to God.
Right.
It doesn't have anything to do with, over here, man with all this free will and now using his intellect and studying the world and coming up with interesting and new ideas and just creating medicines to cure disease, all kinds of new things for
Correct.
A better world. But this only applies, if you will, is in the situation where you want to relate to God.
Correct. Correct. It only applies in a situation where you want to relate to God, which means that we have to answer a question first, which is, who said that we have to or want to relate to God?
And how do, when do we, how do we, under what circumstances?
This is the question of how.
answer to the question of how.
How do we serve God? The answer to the question of how is, the Rambam's terminology, direct, with God, on God's terms. The Kuzari's terminology is through a revealed mechanism. The terminology changes, but the concept is the same. Ultimately, we serve God in the manner in which God determines. Even if we want to think we are doing God a favor by worshiping subsidiaries and subservients, no. God said no. We serve God only in the mechanism by which God determines. Only He can tell us how to serve God. If you think about it philosophically, it's the height of hubris to determine how you're going to serve God. Because what it says is that you know more about God than God. And if you think that you can determine the objective right and wrong way to serve God, that means that you are determining what it is about God that He wants from you. Well, the only one who can make that determination is God. So are you assuming to speak for God? Are you assuming, therefore, that you are in place of God? If you take that logic, that argument to its logical conclusion, you are essentially asserting yourself in place of God. So you are not serving God, you are serving yourself. You are placing yourself and what you perceive to be as your needs before those of an objective determination of the deity. You are making the determination of what God is and therefore what the best way to serve God is. That's why I believe
Avodah Zarah in its purest form, which is simply any Avodah that God doesn't determine, is so connected to Avodat Elilim and Avodat Kochabim Mazalot, which is the grotesque or physical service of items. Avodah Zarah can be pure. None of an Aviyu had the purest of intent. They were seeking spirituality. What's wrong with that? What's wrong with seeking spirituality? What's wrong with seeking more spiritual endeavors and engagements with God? Nadav and Aviyah were destroyed for it. Is that fair? All they really wanted to do was find some additional manifestation, some additional mechanism by which they could come close to God. They could have their own service. They could experience their spirituality in terms of they want, that they feel they need. Is there anything wrong with that?
They were dead wrong.
Right? But they were dead. Why? Because Avodah Zarah, if you think about it logically, if you take it to its logical conclusion, even though it's motivated by pure motives, it's motivated by a real, sincere desire for spirituality, but the determination of how that spirituality is manifest is on my terms. I feel it's right for me. Suddenly we find ourselves talking in terms that are very familiar to us and are very modern. It's right for me. It makes me feel good. I seek spirituality. I'm looking for spiritual experiences. It's very individually centered. It's very self-motivated. Don't tell me what you think objectively spirituality is. I will look into my inner soul and determine what spirituality is. And I will find God. It's very pure. It's very idealistic. At the core, it's Avodah Zarah. Because it is self-determined. And what the Rambam is arguing, what I think the Kuzari is arguing, and every Jewish philosopher has always argued is that if we determine what it is that makes service of God correct, then we are determining what God is. That's the height of idolatry. We are making God in our image instead of striving to be in God's image. And now, suddenly, idolatry has a very modern application.
choices. We have to make choice. We can't always split the hair. So you have a Bratzlav and you have a Lubavitch. And you really have to make a choice at some point. And you might say, I'm more comfortable with Bratzlav. I'm more comfortable with Lubavitch.
And that's why halacha has parameters. And parameters determine, there is a range. Without question, that's why we have a concept called halacha, and we have shivim panim latorah. But there are shivim panim and not shivim ve'echad. Right? The way the analogy I like to use is the 70-lane highway. Right? Shivim panim latorah. There are 70 lanes on this highway, and recognized within the parameters of halacha and Jewish philosophy is acceptable paths to get to the end goal. The end goal. The Kuzari talks about shefa eloki, divine influence. The Rambam talks about the intellectual development of an understanding of God. The end goal is there. Olam Haba, however we want to define it. There are 70 paths within the framework of Torah and Halacha that get us there. But the ends of this 70-lane highway is a cliff and a very steep abyss. Lane 71 is across the cliff. There's no ands, ifs about it. It's 70 and not 71. And there are parameters, there are walls, imaginary walls, but they're there. And they determine the boundary. And not everything can be accepted within the boundary of Shivim Panim Latorah. Not everything can be justified on the basis of Elu Ve'elu. And that's what I think the Rambam in his 13 Ikarim was trying to establish. What are those parameters? Where are the limits? Within those limits, there's great room for maneuvering and changing lanes. But there are definitely limits to what that highway is, how that highway is built. Okay, let me come back to the point at which I began. And the fact that the Rambam spends most of this paragraph trying to explain the how. How is it that we serve God? Well, the answer is on God's terms, directly, through God's definitions, through God's revelation, which will bring us to principle number 6, namely prophecy. But the Rambam spends one half a line doing something which really needs to be established first, which is the notion of... Excuse me? Well, the Avodah Zarah is his conclusion. I have to serve God directly on God's terms, not through an intermediary and not through my own determination. But before I get to the how, right, I have to establish the fact of what? I have to establish the fact that there is such a thing called serving God. Who said? Where did that come from? Maybe I have no purpose to serve God at all. Who said there's even a mandate to serve God? In answer to the question of how I serve God, the Rambam gives me a very defined answer. Namely, directly, not through an intermediary, not through my determination, but through God's determination. I have a very clear answer to the question of how. I'm going to spend the next 5 principles fleshing out the how. But who said I have to do it in the first place? Who said there's any need to serve God? That the Rambam throws in half a sentence in the opening line of this principle.
One word,
ra'ui. One word. Ra'ui le'avdo. Not only is it one word, if you look at the way the formulation of this principle is written, it's the key word. He says the fifth principle is Asher ro'oi le'avdo. The fifth principle is that it is worthwhile serving God. That's the fifth principle. Ask me how? I can now talk about how. Directly, not through an intermediary, etc. But let's first establish the facts. First principle is that it is appropriate, that it is the right thing to do, that it is man's mission to serve God. Where did that come from? How does he make that assertion? He spends very little time elaborating on that assertion.
Whoever named the paragraphs are Ikahe Avodazara.
Well, it gets even better. It gets even better than that. This principle has been the source of great confusion. And I'll show you why. In the davening, we have two summaries of this principle. We have the Ani Mamin and the Yigdal, correct? In the Ani Mamin, this principle is as follows. Ani Mamin b'munah shlema, she'aboreit barach shemo, lo levado ra'ui leitpalel, ve'ein lezulato ra'ui leitpalel. Fifth principle is, says the Ani Mamin, the belief, the trust, that my prayers must be directly to God and not to anything else. So in that, he's done two things. First of all, he has focused on the second half of this, and he's translated the notion of service into the concept of prayer, which is the modern manifestation of service. Fine. In the Yigdal, which is that other summary of the 13 principles, immediately following Kadmon L'chol Davar, for principle number 4, that he came before everything else, is number 5. Hino Adon Olam L'chol Notzar, he is the master of all that has been created, Yoreg G'dulato U'malchuto, demonstrating his greatness and his sovereignty. Do you hear the difference? There's not a word there about idolatry. All it says is, God is king. He demonstrates his greatness and his sovereignty. G'dulato u'malchuto. Yigdal picked up the first sentence, and the Ani Mamin picked up the second sentence. That's how confusing the Sikkar is. Because he spends so much time talking about how. The notion of what? The notion of if. The notion of if. Of the fact that we need to serve God, that we should serve God, that there's a relationship with God, is glossed over, but I don't think it was meant to be glossed over. I think for the Rambam, it was the key phrase. Ra'ui la'avdo. I just think the Rambam didn't have to spend a lot of time discussing it. You know why? Because he's already discussed it in principles 1, 2, 3, and 4. What does it mean? What is principles 1, 2, 3, and 4? 1, creation. 2,
unity.
3, incorporeality. 4, eternity. What do those four principles have in common?
That's God's relationship with man.
Correct. They all define God's relationship to man, which starts at the moment of creation, which continues with the concept that everything in the world comes from God, good and evil, which continues with the notion of the human being being created, B'Tselem Elokim, with an aspect of godliness within him, which talks also about the eternity of God, the separation of God, the fact that God is outside the boundaries of the physical universe. All of that leads to one conclusion. If God is completely outside of the physical universe, if God is completely distant, completely removed from, and no frame of reference in our human experience possibly can contain God, then I have to ask a very simple question. Which is?
How do you relate back to God?
Why did God create the world? Why did God enter into this relationship with man? Fair question to ask. God created the world, entered into a relationship with the world. God created the spiritual dimension of the human being. Why?
To have a relationship.
If not, the assumption that this relationship had to be reciprocal. If God enters into our domain, Kaviyachal, if God relates to the human being, then it stands to reason by assumption that we have to relate back to God in some way, that it has to be a two-way street. That's the assumption I think the Rambam makes. By the time he finishes talking about principles 1, 2, 3, and 4, He's essentially said God has gone out of his way to create a world in which he can relate to us. Now, the question is, how do we reciprocate? And that's why he assumes, Ra'u'il Avdo, of course there has to be reciprocity. Of course there has to be relationship back to God. Otherwise, what's the exercise for? So the rest of the Ikarim are essentially a way of answering the question of how, not what. And what is a given? We have to serve God. We have to relate to God. There has to be a relationship between man and God. The only question left is how. How starts with the definition of Avodah Zarah, a right way and a wrong way. We know what the wrong way looks like. We know what the wrong way looks like. What the right way looks like, that we have to still work our way through the rest of the story. We are going to adjourn here.